Now, in these paragraphs, Sri Aurobindo is opening up the whole idea of knowledge and the exceeding of our human forms of knowledge towards a knowledge by identity. So here, the idea is that our present condition of knowing is one which proceeds through thinking, through a kind of ignorance, which puts together various inferences about what we see, feel, experience. But there are higher possibilities of knowledge which belong to a more cosmic kind of mind, which in a sense is accessible to us, the greater the silence of the ordinary mind. The normal thinking mind, as it falls silent, can open to the activity of these higher cosmic forms of mind or levels of mind, and these actions develop a different kind of knowledge, a knowledge which is more sure of itself, because it is ultimately based on a knowledge by identity. The whole idea is that one moves into a certain kind of remembrance. And so here, the idea of smriti or remembrance is something which comes into play. The remembrance arises because in our depths, we are one with all things. That oneness has been lost, and hence, in this opening up of the cosmic planes, a greater closeness to that sense of oneness brings us knowledge. Now, where we are right now, Sri Aurobindo has identified three rungs, as it were, in the transition out of our normal condition of knowing to a greater certainty of knowing. The first rung is what he calls the higher mind. The higher mind is the mind of cognition, of cosmic thinking, 1 minute. This is the kind of mind from which the philosopher, scientist, or mathematician draws his highest intuitions. It is not limited to one schema of the world, but can see reality in many various schemas, all these various schematics through which we can describe the universe philosophically, coexist, as it were, in a certain kind of cosmic domain. But this is experienced as a form of thinking in idea. We receive an idea of things. Now, receiving an idea is still something which has been represented in terms of thought. But thought itself rests on something even more primordial. Even in our own thinking, we find that there is something subtler than thought. We discussed this some time back regarding the distinction between word, thought, and sight, a pure idea. And this notion of a pure idea, which is behind what we call thought, and even further behind the varied formulation of thought in words, is something which moves into sight. So we move from a cosmic thinking to a cosmic visioning, or a kind of illumined mind. Sri Aurobindo calls this level the illumined mind. Illumined mind is no longer trammeled by ideas, but is closer to a direct seeing, a visioning of things. There's a capturing of the reality of things through vision. Now, he says these two levels also rest on a third level, which goes even beyond vision into a kind of remembrance of oneness. That is where the smriti really begins to act in a very, very subtle manner, as if we don't need any forms of representation, because ultimately even vision is a form of representation. We represent reality to ourselves through vision. even more primordially, we just have a bodiless knowledge of our identity with things. That kind of knowledge starts revealing itself in that third form of the cosmic mind, which he calls intuition. So intuition is the level that he has begun opening up over here in the chapter that we just considered. And here he is saying that intuition yields a certain kind of very familiar, intimate knowledge of things, a knowledge transcending various forms of representation. Having said that, he turns around and starts talking about the limitations of all these forms of knowledge. They are not sufficient. Firstly, he points to the problem of misunderstanding. The fact that whatever we may call intuition or we may call prescience ultimately falls into a mixed medium, which is the condition of our consciousness, and gets distorted. Secondly, these forms are mixed up with a variety of communications that come in from variety of other levels. So there is possible a purity of understanding which rises higher than our normal mentality. But there is also a variety of messages that we are receiving from the universal consciousness around us, which are of a variety of motives. A lot of them are received by us purely by the openness of our own ego to approach something that flatters it or that gives it some kind of bearing. So these communications are often mistaken to be intuitions. They are often called intuitions. And Sri Aurobindo in his own time is using the term the infra-rational mystic for these kinds of communications. In today's world, these are called the psychics, largely. Now, he says that it is a danger to throw away the crutch of reason before there has been a sufficient amount of purification of the nature. And a reliance on these forms of intuition can be very dangerous before that. So, the use of reason along with the developing clarity of intuition is what he recommends in this transition. However, he also points out that were this intuition to rest on the crutch of reason, then it would be no intuition. It would be something that is constantly troubled by the law of the reason. So we cannot go far enough with this constant battling or struggling between some form of knowledge which is trying to emerge from a higher source and our more crippled form of knowledge which is a normal operation. But this is a problem. That's why he recognizes this problem. This is a severe limitation, but this is part of the condition of being human. Now, the other problem he points out is that intuitions are sporadic and fragmentary in nature. Though we may arrive at a clarity of seeing something, there isn't a sufficient wideness which explains things to each other, and we often have to use our reason to add up these various intuitions and make sense of them. Now, here again he points out, it is possible to replace this kind of activity by a succession of intuitions. If we open up the power of receiving intuitions, we have to exercise it. Just as, for example, the poet exercises the power of inspiration to arrive at a large sort of linked ideas that are expressed in a certain manner. So too, intuitions may be exercised to arrive at linked ideas that give us totalities of sight. Now, that, however, is still a construction. And again, that is one of the limitations, that it doesn't necessarily come all at once. It comes in bits and pieces. This is going to be the basis on which he will develop what is necessary, why it is not possible to stop at this point, though we've reached very high in our access to some kind of direct knowledge. So here is where we are at this point.
Thank you, Devashishtha. That was a wonderful summary. Vince, would you like to start?
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Intuition is always an edge, a ray, or outleap of a superior light. It is, in us, a projecting blade, edge, or point of a far-off supermind light entering into and modified by some intermediate truth-mind substance above us and, so modified, again entering into and very much blinded by our ordinary or ignorant mind substance. But on that higher level to which it is native, its light is unmixed and therefore entirely and purely veridical. And its rays are not separated, but connected or massed together in a play of rays of what might almost be called in the Sanskrit poetic figure, a sea or mass of stable lightnings. When this original, a native intuition, begins to descend into us, an answer to an ascension of our consciousness to its level, or as a result of our finding of a clear way of communication with it, it may continue to come as a play of lightning flashes, isolated or in constant action. But at this stage, the judgment of reason becomes quite implacable. It can only act as an observer, a registrar, understanding or recording the more luminous intimations, judgments, and discriminations of the higher power. To complete or verify an isolated intuition or discriminate its nature, its applications, its limitations, the receiving consciousness must rely on another completing intuition, or be able to call down a massed intuition capable of putting all in place. For once the process of the change has begun, a complete transmutation of the stuff and activities of the mind into the substance, form, and power of intuition is imperative. Until then, so long as the process of consciousness depends upon lower intelligence serving or helping out or using the intuition, the result can only be a survival of the mixed knowledge-ignorance, uplifted or relieved by a higher line of force acting in its parts of knowledge.
So this is a continuation of what he has introduced and some of the thoughts that we discussed just now are continued in this short paragraph. What he is pointing out is that the intuition itself is a intermediate plane and that it is receiving its knowledge from a higher source. It is almost like a kind of aurora borealis, if one might make that analogy of lights that are shifting and flashing in an intermediate plane with something greater above it, where it is more stable. Now here he uses the term veridical, which points to what might be called self-evident knowledge, knowledge which does not require external proofs, but is known to itself through identity. So in its own plane, that sense sense of the knowledge by identity is part of its native experience. But as this kind of knowledge comes down into our more mixed consciousness, that sense of self-evident nature starts getting mixed. Now, the other thing is that in its own level, even though it seems to be of a sporadic and fragmentary nature, it is a mass of such kind of seeings that compose its own plane. That's why he talks in the Vedic image of a mass or sea of stable lightning, the sea of lightnings.
Oh.
Now, again, at our level, these lightnings are coming in isolated instances. And this is why he's pointing to the fact that there have to be either the use of the reason or mind to add up these lightnings and make sense of them, or bringing down of a number of these, a whole linked succession of these kind of intuitions to give a larger picture. Now, the difficulty of trying to mix reason with intuition is that at this level, the seeing is of such a great, difference in nature of quality from that of reason, that the mixture doesn't go well. And that's why it is not possible to do this kind of, mixing or adding of reason to the actions of the intuition anymore. But one has to gradually put the reason into silence and become purified in the approach to the intuition, so that pure intuitions only can complete each other. And then he points to the other possibility, which is that of the wideness of consciousness, that instead of drawing a linked chain of intuitions, brings down a massed intuition. And that's what he's talking about here, that, the higher one goes in the seeing of intuition, the larger, wider, and more massed these intuitions become, so that one can see more and more all at once. So this is the way in which the progress of this kind of knowledge goes. But as he says, so long as the process of consciousness depends on the lower intelligence, the result can only be a survival of a mixed knowledge. It's a mixture of knowledge and ignorance, which at best comes to the mystic, or the person who is trying to arrive at this kind of seeing.
Is it possible to elaborate on the what we really refer to as reason? Like, for example, reason, as I'm thinking, is that putting things together and link them together, right? Like, that if you gather things from a higher plane, it could be a higher reason also, right? And linking them. But of course, the linking reason could be on the end of the line. But anyway, but basically just the term reason.
Yes, reason, as he's using it, you're absolutely right in that there can be a higher reason as well. But reason as he's using it is essentially the ability to use certain operations of mentality. Operations like inference, deduction, analogy, induction, and also ability to classify things, put them to various kinds of schemes of likeness and difference. These powers of organization and inference of prediction ultimately to form pictures, representations of reality, are the domain of reason. Now, there may be a higher reason, which is, you're absolutely right, he also talks about a supramental reason for that matter, where the same operations are being carried out. Operation of organization, selection, classification are carried out, but they are not using the same powers of deduction, induction, and those kinds of operations to arrive at these various classificatory schemes, organization schemes. So certain aspects of reason are being utilized in a certain way through, you see, for example, one might think about machine reason in artificial intelligence, how a machine can be made to add. That is basically a very rudimentary or elementary operation of reason using, forms of inference. So that kind of reason, that elementary reason is also going on inside our mind. Our mind is building its reason structures through various kinds of forms of calculation of that type. However, there are other forms. One of the major differences between machine reason and human reason is the fact that human reason operates much quicker than machine reason in many ways. Now, this quickness of operation is not only due to a quicker calculation, but because there are other operations, higher operations of reason that are coexisting with these elementary functions. Oftentimes, we use our intuition much quicker to arrive at results than using these deduction facilities or faculties. So that is what he's talking about reason. Reason, there's a whole range, one may say, from what the most elementary functions of reason to forms of cognition and seeing that ultimately lead us outside of the normal intellect.
In fact, while you were explaining, one just formulation got into my head. Tell me whether it's correct or not. The kind of reason that you were talking about induction and all those few other words you've used. That is like. Reason is being sort of a indirect source of knowledge, is used as a source of indirect knowledge, whereas in kind of higher reasoning is like a delightful, playful organization of the direct knowledge, meaning the reason is not the source of knowledge, the knowledge is direct, but reason is organizing them and seeing the play. Sort of thing. Whereas in the lower reason, like the ordinary reasoning, we try to sort of know something by reasoning, not know and then reason, and then organize, but then by the very organization, we try to know something. And there, obviously, there are some indirect assumptions and, some obscurity always will be there because the knowledge is not direct.
Yes, you're exactly right. That is the primary difference between the operation of reason as an instrument of truth in its proper operation, because he is also talking about the transformation of our normal mind into a province of supermind. And if that happens, then that is exactly how the transformed reason works, or how even what Sri Aurobindo is calling the supramental reason works, in that it is a instrument of play to create creative organizations of truth, of knowledge by identity. How can we can organize it in a variety of ways, and each form of organization really is a form of delight that sets up certain conditions of play, you may say. So that kind of utilization of reason is more that higher type, but in our normal condition, it is a groping instrument of knowledge. It is moving in the ignorance. It is always moving in the ignorance. We can never arrive at knowledge, because whatever we can reason is ultimately only a more or less probable ignorance. So that is the condition of it trying to be an instrument of knowledge, as against being an instrument, or rather instrument towards knowledge, or against being an instrument of knowledge. Used by it.
Um, So Devashishtha, so the reason that question comes is also that most of us, when we go through the thinking process, it is not subtle enough that we can distinguish between, oh, now we are deducing, now we are extrapolating, now we've gotten something from the subconscious. It's not that subtle enough. So it's just some big mass of stuff happened and we arrived at a conclusion. So it's not broken down that much. Can you talk about how to, like, help us figure out how to break it down that way? Like, what are some exercises you can do?
Well, you're right in that normally what our normal operation of coming to knowledge, coming to know things, is a mixed operation, as you said, a mixed knowledge dash ignorance. There is some intuition involved, there is some, you know, rationality involved, there is some degree of just the prompting of the vital involved. Ego and desire are biasing our knowledge also to some extent. All this goes towards making judgments for us. Now, here exactly, I mean, even before coming to yoga, this is one of the major problems that philosophers have faced regarding the human nature. This is one of the major kind of, you know, questions that, for example, forms the backbone of the thinking of Immanuel Kant. And that's why what is called the Enlightenment in the West is really an attempt to release the reason from its bondage to a variety of irrational factors as well as various kinds of, you know, I mean, even supra-rational, what we may call communications. What is it that is the domain of the reason's purity of action? That becomes important to isolate if one is to even overcome it. And there we find that the power of reasoning has to purify itself by opening to, you know, by discrimination and by observation of where are the points where there is the, you know, the sort of entry, infiltration of the vital, for example, or where are the points where we are jumping into to certain conclusions and why are we jumping to those conclusions. So it is only by observation, careful observation, that we can release the reason and give it a certain degree of critical freedom. I think that so-called enlightenment, which what is the Western idea of the freedom of reason, is also a very important step in this direction. Based on that, there can be an opening to how those kind of, you know, the whole life. Enterprise, in fact, of the Western Academy is to arrive at that purity of the reason that can operate with the rigor of logic. The whole field of logic is ultimately a discipline towards the freeing of the reason into its, you know, operations which are not, you know, infiltrated by a variety of other kinds of, you know, forces. Now, of course, if superiority enters into that operation, if it begins thinking of itself as the highest faculty available to human beings, or even the leading faculty that all human beings ought to have, then there are problems that come with it, because it is also an operation of ignorance, but it arrogates to itself the place of knowledge. So here is where one has to carefully untangle the various kinds of forces that go towards making judgments in us. And each of these has to be opened to something higher in it. Feelings can also give us knowledge. As you point out, this plane of intuition is not merely mental. Plane of intuition can operate in the mind, can operate through our feelings. It can operate through our will directly. It can operate through the body as well. So all these forms of intuition need to be opened up, but they can only be opened up after untangling them in our judgments. Judgments have to be perceptive. Power of observation, impersonal observation has to be present so that we can see what is influencing what. And each one of these powers of judgment has to be opened to its own form of intuition.
Actually, regarding this Western Academy that you mentioned, this rigor thing, it's also relative, right? Like, it basically sometimes becomes a power game after all, because, you know, person who has more, you know, vocabulary can win over someone's knowledge, which could be even superior, because it didn't have the right vocabulary or enough vocabulary to express. So, how much does it rely on the direct knowledge, which is ultimately the soul? Because reason, as we were talking about, that if it doesn't depend on the direct knowledge or higher source of knowledge, ultimately it becomes a power game of some kind, right?
No, of course, it can always be a power game of some kind, and it's very true that whatever we call the academy is also a play of power. Ultimately, the whole of social existence can be seen in terms of a play of power. But I believe what we are talking about with regard to the freedom of the reason is to be taken at an individual level, not so much in terms of vocabulary, but in terms of clarity of thinking. It doesn't matter what one, of course, what one does with the clarity of thinking in terms of, you know, dominating others, etc., is another thing. But if we look at it from the viewpoint of the growth of knowledge, true growth of knowledge, its utility lies in being able to decipher what is clear thinking and what is muddy thinking. So that's the, I think, the gain that comes from rigor or disciplined, you know, training in thinking that the academy provides. Apart from that, of course, specialized understanding using vocabulary, etc., is another thing. And there I agree that there is operation of knowledge in, of ignorance in a variety of ways that can open itself to a play of power. But ultimately, any kind of specialized understanding has to rest on truth and on intuition. So the only utility of this rigor is to arrive at a clarity of what constitutes thought and to take out the mixture of irrationality from it so that it can open to its own higher sources.
I remember reading a letter from Sri Aurobindo in which he says that a person with a more developed mind may express better whatever little he receives, but on the other hand, somebody with a less developed mind may be receiving far more.
Yeah, this is possible. But of course, you know, question of receiving is another thing. I mean, here we are talking about knowledge as such. You know, expression is an aspect of knowledge. It's representation making. Even if one doesn't express through words, or even in writing, one is expressing to oneself. Nevertheless, knowledge is ultimately something which is, now, if you can kind of consider, for example, the difference between mystics, some of whom have experiences of very high kinds, but cannot even, you know, represent these experiences to themselves in any, you know, ordered form. And other mystics who are what one might call mystic philosophers, like Sri Aurobindo, for example, who can give schemes of what they experience. The difference between them is this problem of knowledge. Experience, human experience, or even mystic experience is not only knowledge. Evolution of consciousness is not merely an evolution of knowledge, but evolution of knowledge is one aspect of the evolution of consciousness.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you, Devashishra. Very nice.
This is the scheme of knowledge is intuition.
Can't hear you clearly, Sitaram. Can you be louder, little louder?
Sorry, Sitaram. I was talking actually, and I was muted. Can I continue before?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Sorry about this. What I'm trying to say, that what I was referring to, is that unless I mean, this rigor, discipline, all those things ultimately are relative, because unless the source of knowledge is identified as something which you don't have, then the relative things become a power game after all. But if the relative things are, considered as an instrument and nothing else, then it is an whole different matter. What I mean is that what I have seen, I mean, of course, I have not been exactly directly in the academic world, but in the Western, that assumption of that the higher source is not with us, we are doping for it, that assumption may not always be there. In the rigor and discipline, all these things ultimately get possessed by the ego or get possessed by some kind of power which has a motive.
No doubt. You see, the whole thing about what we call about the academy, etc., that is that it is limited. Ultimately, this whole enterprise of what is called the Enlightenment, which has opened up the modern academy, has this problem in it. Nobody is saying that it is good. In fact, it's been criticized left and right, and one's right in criticizing it. But what I'm pointing out is that if we look at it from another viewpoint, a viewpoint of the future, not about how it is practiced, but about how it may be practiced, if somebody wants to utilize this discipline of clarity towards something higher, then it is of use to distinguish what is the power of reason, not so much the content of, and use of these things, but it can be utilized as a power of clarity in, purifying the reason and liberating it. Ultimately, that is the origin of this whole idea of enlightenment comes from that. It stops short because you're right, they don't see anything beyond it. And as a relative power, it can't give us purity, fullness of knowledge. So it ultimately starts, becoming utilized by the games of power. That is, in fact, one of the major critiques of the whole Enlightenment in today's thinking, is that purity of knowledge is always, tainted by the play of power, because this kind of knowledge does not have any fullness in it. But if we change that into another kind of operation, we can see that for those who wish to purify the reason and free it from various irrationalities, it has a disciplining power.
Sitaram, did you want to say something?
Yeah, actually I've asked a question, or more actually in terms of the first part, basically the thought, vision, and then the remembrance. This is the sequence, if you were to understand, basically the intuition is a knowledge coming out of story. Is that way? Basically, you have experiences, and maybe without that, you have some kind of a remembrance. And this intuition is the knowledge coming out of that story. Is that correct understanding, Devishi?
Yeah, that's how I understand it, and that's how, there are kind of very interesting passages in the record of yoga where it's like the reversal of the theory of knowledge that comes to us in Indian tradition, where origin of knowledge is Shruti and inference out of Shruti is Smriti. But in this subjective scale of knowledge, this particular understanding is exactly reversed, because Shruti is that which we take for granted. It comes to us as it were from another source. There is the sense of receiving something from another source. Smriti is when it begins to be revealed that this source is inside ourselves itself. It is self-knowledge that we are remembering. So as we move from higher knowledge through illumined knowledge to intuition, character of this knowledge starts changing from Shruti to Smriti. It is personal or one's own cosmic knowledge, one's sense of self. In the whole notion of calling it Smriti is also a transformation of the sense of self. Sense of self is coming into closer identity with cosmic Purusha.
Devashish?
Yeah.
I don't know if this is completely relevant, but one time when I was in Pondicherry, I heard this singer. He was a Baul singer, B-A-U-L?
Yeah, yes, Vince. Baul is a Bengali singer, mystic singer, yes.
Yeah, he was absolutely wonderful. I listened to him. He could really sing his aspiration in a language, of course, I couldn't understand, but communicated extremely strongly. I mean, isn't that a kind of knowledge? He would impart his knowledge of aspiration to someone else. It was very strong. I mean, I would have followed the guy around just to hear him sing if I wasn't, already obligated.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Because there again, what you were saying about intuition as a form of direct knowledge operating at different levels comes into place. This is what is called samjana, which is knowledge through the senses and the feelings. There is a certain intuition through which we receive a sense of experience in the feelings. It is as if you understood what the person was saying even without knowing what the words were in the truth of the feeling. That is part of this intuitional knowledge, which is samjana. Some people have the ability to communicate it, just as poets have the ability to communicate maybe prajnana through thought, knowledge. I mean, like what we are reading itself is a form of prajnana, because at some level there is a resonance of the spiritual content or experiential content of what is being written. So too, in a deeper or inner cognition, so too there may be a direct touch of some experience in the inner feeling, which is part of the intuition and what Sri Aurobindo calls samjana.
Wasn't that like a remembrance too? I mean...
Yeah, I mean that sense of remembrance exactly... Yeah.
It is not intellectual.
Characterizes that. Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's not intellectual knowledge, but it was another level of knowledge.
There is almost a sense as if you know it too, even in the communication.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That it belongs to you as well.
But it's coming from other.
Right, right.
Not from, well, then it joined. It came from inside me too.
Correct.
No, thank you very much.
Sitaram, would you like to read the next one?
Sure. Intuition has a fourfold power. The power of revelatory truth-seeing, the power of inspiration or truth-hearing, the power of truth-touch or immediate seizing of significance, which is akin to the ordinary nature of its intervention in our mental intelligence, the power of true and automatic discrimination of the orderly and exact relation of truth to truth. These are the fourfold potencies of intuition. Intuition can therefore perform all the action of reason, including the function of logical intelligence, which is to work out the right relation of things and the right relation of idea with idea, but by its own superior process and with steps that do not fail or falter. It takes up also and transforms into its own substance not only the mind of thought, but the heart and life and the sense and physical consciousness. Already all these have their own peculiar powers of infusion derived from the hidden light. The pure power descending from above can assume them all into itself and impart to these deeper heart perception and life perceptions and the divinations of the body a greater integrality and perfection. It can thus change the whole consciousness into the shop of intuition, for it brings its own greater radiant movement into the will, into the feelings and emotions, the life impulses, the action of sense and sensation, the very workings of the body consciousness. It recasts them in the light and power of truth and illumines their knowledge and their ignorance. A certain integration can thus take place, but whether it is a total integration must depend on the extent to which the new light is able to take up the subconscious and penetrate the fundamental inconscious. Here, the intuitive light and power may be hampered in its task because it is the edge of a delegated and modified supermind, but does not bring in the whole mass or body of the identity knowledge. The basis of consciousness in our nature is too vast, deep and solid to be altogether penetrated, turned into light, transformed by an inferior power of the group nature.
So here Sri Aurobindo is touching on several things that we've just discussed. Firstly, he starts off by talking about the four powers of intuition. Now these four powers of intuition, they also operate at other levels. But this is their origin. Origin of these four powers is in this plane called intuition. So the four powers are what he elsewhere calls revelation, inspiration, intuition proper, and discrimination. So, revelation, though he has talked about revelation more with regard to the higher mind, the power of visioning, and inspiration is also the power of the higher mind in the power of truth audition, so to say, that the two combined form this knowledge that is seen and heard at the same time as it performs. The two major forms of representation by which we arrive at knowledge through the senses. These are our two major senses. One is seeing and one is hearing. But when we come to the subtler senses, we find that these senses that are less utilized by us nevertheless have subtler potencies. For example, the sense of touch. Sense of touch also, just as seeing and hearing, are powers that ultimately can be turned within rather than we use to turn on the outer world, and can be raised in their functioning from even a sense of dreaming or receiving communications from the environment to a purity of divine sight and divine hearing. So too, the sense of touch can be turned inward. And firstly, it may be felt as a sensory inner experience, but it ultimately reveals itself to be something even more of primary or intimate as the touch of mind on mind, the mental touch. The mental touch is something which ultimately goes back beyond the senses. The mental touch is related to what Sri Aurobindo calls the sixth sense. Sixth sense is almost like a sensing beyond the organized sense organs that we have. So that kind of essentiality of sense belongs to the third factor, which is the intuition. Intuition has that sense of intimacy because it does not rely on the powers of sensory expression. even in its inward quality. So that is ultimately the nature of the third power of intuition. The fourth power of discrimination is a variation of that intuition applied to the power of choice. How are we to arrive at purity of perception is given to us at any level by this developing viveka or power of discrimination. So intuition in its action ultimately boils down to the development of these four powers gradually in us. The first of these powers that must develop is the discrimination. By the developing power of an intuitive discrimination, we manage to purify ourselves by rejecting what we don't need to go for and by accepting what will give us greater variety. In this process, this sense of intimate understanding starts developing, and along with it, the sense, inner senses start responding to these representations of truth sight and truth hearing. Truth sight and truth hearing cannot be trusted in its full unless the third power of pure intuition as mental touch is not experienced behind them. Behind all our representations stands something very essential. That essentiality has to emerge if there is the sense of certainty. So that is one area where he opens up this development or yoga of the intuition. Then he goes on to talk about how, you see here the question of that was asked about what is the reason is also answered very essentially by Sri Aurobindo. Says, he uses the term here, intuition can therefore perform the action of reason, then he defines it, including the function of logical intelligence, which is to work out the right relation of things and the right relation of idea with idea. Now this putting in place, organizing, selecting and classifying, which is the place of reason, is something which we achieve through the powers of deduction, induction, and other kind of logical faculties. But these same things can be achieved in a much more sure way as representations of truth, as what was called forms of play of the truth by this higher intuition. So we don't, it is not that we need this, but that it is possible to replace the operations of the lower reason, a lower logical intelligence, by the operation of the intuition. So that's why he points to the fact that this can be completely replaced by another function. Then he goes on to talk about this functioning is not merely mental. And here we go back to the idea that the higher we go above the normal range of human mentality, this alienation of mind from the rest of the being, the alienation of mentality, vitality, emotions, will, body, that is gradually overcome. That overcoming takes place to the degree that one rises above, because from the range of higher mind, there is a certain amount of integration of the being that starts occurring, which is greater than what we have known. But still it is not complete. Here in the intuition, a much greater degree of the integration takes place. That is because a pure intuition of mind, of will, of emotion, feeling, sensations, physical action, can all be opened up. They all can be transformed by the purity of this intuition. Each one of our various planes of consciousness or forms of consciousness can have its own perfect intuition. That kind of integration leads to an intuitive being. Now this is a very important step or stage as Sri Aurobindo sees it. That's why this consciousness holds a very, very important intermediate function for us to rise to and modify our existence into in the transition to a supramental life. However, he points out that even this cannot go sufficiently low into the inconscient. Subconscious and inconscious have a massive quality, a quality of something which, you know, is rooted in a tremendous rock of ignorance. So that's why he has used the term, the dragon of the dark inconscious. This dragon power is what, in a sense, is not irradiated by the lightnings of the intuition. Lightnings of the intuition are not powerful enough to tear the massive quality of darkness that is held by the inconscious. This is the reason why we can integrate up to a certain level, but a universal transformation is not possible through the intuition. For that, as he says, something more must come.
So could you relate that to what Sri Aurobindo and the mother have said about how, like, after a certain point, further progress is only possible when the whole of the society, or when the people around have progressed. So an individual progress is only possible to a certain degree. After that, the people around also have to progress for the consciousness to advance. Could you relate that to how all this comes into play with that?
Yeah, this is also true. This is very true. Though at this point what Sri Aurobindo is talking about is the individual progress, but where that is really true is the fact that to develop a large degree of universality and also to arrive at a life divine, as he calls it, at a condition of the expression or manifestation of truth, it is necessary for larger numbers of people to kind of arrive at these experiences. Integration of these kind of higher powers in an individual can go quite far and can even come to a point where the entire supramental transformation is possible in one person. But at the same time, if it does not affect some other people in a progressive manner, then it is left vibrating there maybe for a very long time for posterity without being able to effect any wider change. I think for that reason, more than the fact that we cannot actually affect the transformation of this unconsciousness, it is necessary to open up more and more collective advances.
Yeah, thank you, Devashish. That's good to clarify that. So that's at a much later stage and not really for, it's for the life divine, the manifestation of the life divine rather than for any individual transformation.
Yeah,
thank you,
but instead of a later stage, you see that question Sri Aurobindo and the mother have dealt with, they have given their attention to that question in a number of places. And in both of their answers to the question, it appears as if finding people who are open and willing to progress to whatever extent together is a very good condition to, arrive at something higher which has a manifestation of some kind. And since we are to have a manifestation, this kind of collective advance is of importance. But at the same time, what usually goes by that name is a certain kind of, stasis of collective consciousness, or a condition in which individual growth is hampered by, dependence on others. Mm-hmm. So for some kind of a very large yogic consciousness like Sri Aurobindo or the mother, to include others in their own journey helps in widening the scope of the transformation, certainly. But there are attendant dangers, which in the individual case are better dealt with by being very selective and by being focused on the internal sort of ascent and advance.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Devashish.
So, Devashish, can you say that at a collective, you encounter same sort of a dragon as in an individual you encounter with the subconscious or inconscient?
To some extent, yes, because you see, any collective has a certain degree of collective unconsciousness. I mean, I'm not talking about this in Jungian terms. Jung uses the term collective unconscious. But I'm talking about a collective unconsciousness, which is a province of the inconscious that in some way is more amplified because it is being expressed to a variety of people. So there is a kind of anonymity into which one thinks. Individual consciousness sinks into an anonymity in the we. You know, this we is a sort of a dead blanket where there is a sense of vigorous comfort and warmth, but at the same time, there isn't the power to make much advance. This is a very old problem, and in modern times, it has been talked about quite a lot. You know, particularly the difficulty of, on the one hand, you know, tearing oneself free from the environment to make progress, and on the other hand, of being able to carry others with one or make a general advance. You see, so this is a problem, a certain kind of a problem of the nature, which has to be tackled by each individual in an individual way. There is no general solution to it. But at any point, it is important to be clear about what are the forces involved and what it is that one is doing.
In fact, I was thinking of two terms. One is the terms are basically, one is humility, another is effort. These two, I think, I don't know. I mean, I'm tempted to say that I feel more humility in an environment like India and more effort in the more effort in a sense, like more effort without necessarily survival issue, effort to become better or do better in the Western. It could be, my perception could be biased or partial. But what I'm trying to say is this, does Shobhini talk about this humility and effort anywhere?
No, he doesn't. As far as I know, because I have not, I mean, sort of perhaps read everything, but I've not come across exactly this terminology. But what you're saying certainly has, resonance. There are places where both Sri Aurobindo and Mother have talked about what can be called cultural psychology. In other words, you know, a whole history of the way in which people have developed consciousness predominates a certain type of psychology in one sort of, you know, place of people, culture, and another in another. And certainly the Western sort of consciousness has moved towards a more individualistic form. In particularly in modern times, the emergence of the individual, maybe that is what one might call effort. The effort of the individual, the struggle of the individual to free himself or herself from all various kinds of conditioning and make progress. And on the other hand, one might think about a kind of a consciousness that has been more gregarious, has been more in terms of the acceptance of others. From that point of view, humility, you know, as a condition in which a greater wideness has, developed. So, one could talk about it in these terms, and both these factors are important to be integrated in the process of advance.
Luis, would you like to read next?
Sure. Next step of the ascent brings us to the open mind, the intuitional.
Hey, can you be a little louder?
Yeah, very soft, can't be heard.
Can you hear? Is this good? Is this better?
Yeah, much better.
The next step of the ascent brings us to the overmind. The intuitional change can only be an introduction to this higher spiritual overture. But we have seen that the overmind, even when it is selective and not total in its action, is still a power of cosmic consciousness.
It actually becomes soft.
We can't hear you at all. Luis, are you using a mic?
Yeah.
Somehow we couldn't hear you at all. We heard only the first few words and then it fell into complete silence.
How about now?
Yeah, now it's good.
I think the mic is moving or something, so I just want to be careful with the position.
Okay. I'll start over. The next step of the ascent brings us to the overmind. The intuitional change can only be an introduction to this higher spiritual overture. We have seen that the overmind, even when it is selective and not total in its action, is still a power of cosmic consciousness, a principle of global knowledge, which carries in it a delegated light from the supermental gnosis. It is therefore only by an opening into the cosmic consciousness that the overmind ascent and descent can be made wholly possible. A high and intense individual opening upwards is not sufficient. To that vertical ascent towards summit light, there must be added a vast horizontal expansion of the consciousness into some totality of the spirit. At the least, the inner being must already have replaced, by its deeper and wider awareness, the surface mind and its limited outlook, and learn to live in a large universality. For otherwise, the overmind view of things and the overmind dynamism will have no room to move in and effectuate its dynamic operations. When the overmind descends, predominance of the centralizing ego sense is entirely subordinated, lost in largeness of being, and finally abolished. A wide cosmic perception and feeling of a boundless universal self and movement replaces it. Many motions that were formerly egocentric may still continue, but they occur as currents or ripples in cosmic wideness. Thought, for the most part, no longer seems to originate individually in the body or the person, but manifests from above or comes in upon the cosmic mind waves. All inner individual sight or intelligence of things is now a revelation or illumination of what is seen or comprehended. But the source of the revelation is not in one separate self, but in the universal knowledge. The feelings, emotions, sensations are similarly felt as waves from the cosmic immensity, breaking upon the subtle and the gross body, and responded to in kind by the individual center of the universality. For the body is only a small support, or even less, a point of relation for the action of a vast cosmic instrumentation. In this boundless largeness, not only the separate ego, but all sense of individuality, even of a subordinated or instrumental individuality, may entirely disappear. The cosmic existence, the cosmic consciousness, the cosmic delight, the play of cosmic forces are alone left. The delight or the center of force is felt and what was the personal mind, life, or body, it is not with a sense of personality, but as a field of manifestation. And this sense of the delight or of the action of force is not confined to the person or the body, but can be felt at all points in an unlimited consciousness of unity which pervades everywhere.
So, this is the ascent to what Sri Aurobindo calls the cosmic consciousness. And the development of these forms of knowledge ultimately find their home here, because what was being received as before, as flashes, even as a linked set of flashes, what he calls a sea of lightnings, here becomes a mass of light. It's interesting that in the use of metaphors, Sri Aurobindo utilizes metaphors which more and more have some resemblance to the idea of the sun. Because elsewhere, when he talks about the overmind, he has used the term penumbra for it. We may think of the solar flares, for example, as constituting these intuitions of the intuition. And beyond it, the penumbra, which is the, range of the light extending out of the sun, as the area of the overmind. This massive consciousness is something which is characteristic of overmind, and he uses the term global consciousness elsewhere for it. This term, Sri Aurobindo's use of the term global consciousness, naturally was much before this term became popular or common to modern mind. In today's world, the term is of common usage, globalization, etc. But when Sri Aurobindo was using it in the 1940s, it was relatively unknown. But one got the sense of something which was massive and all-inclusive. So, this to arrive here, transit here, from the intuition, as he's pointing out, a radical change must take place. This radical change is a horizontal extension. As he points out here, the two kinds of spiritual movements, the vertical ascension and the horizontal extension, these two come together in overmind. A horizontal extension can take place long before there is any vertical movement. Brahman can be experienced, spirit can be experienced, even at the level of the physical, the vital, or the lower ranges of mind. But that kind of experience is not that of the overmind, because here it combines a tremendous ascending power with a all-embracing wideness. But that ability to extend oneself towards universality, even at the lower levels, is a great help. That's why he says that the surface mind must already have seeded to some sense of the infinite, sense of the universal, if this transition is to occur from the intuition to the overmind. This is why one may say that collective advance, if it is considered in a true spiritual manner, can help the individual to universalize or prepare for this kind of change. Also, it can help to widen the being at any level, so that gradually there is a sense of vastness that pervades the consciousness. As the silence increases, there can be felt this contact with what Sri Aurobindo is here calling the overmind. So, this again is something that can come down into the being and occupy the field of consciousness of the nature. And he talks over here in this paragraph about its effects. Mainly the effects are the sense of an infinite consciousness which occupies one's identity. No longer is there the sense that one is a limited center of existence alone, a certain kind of egocentricity, but on the other hand, as if one exists everywhere. This decentralization of the identity and a sense of the cosmic vastness of being is, in a way, one's identity with one's coming into unity with the cosmic Purusha. To whatever extent this Purusha is experienced concretely, the effect of its existence everywhere as one's own existence characterizes the cosmic consciousness of the overmind. Then he talks about how that sense is carried at every level of being. How the thoughts are not felt as if generated or originated in one's quote-unquote mind, but come on these cosmic waves using this so-called little center of existence as their form of expression or their form of communication. So too, the feelings come on these vast universal waves, and other parts also experience that same kind of universality and channeling of something universal. One thing about particularly the mind that he makes clear is that the center of one's existence shifts at this point. We've talked about how, with even the beginning of these cosmic ranges with the higher mind, there is more and more a living above what one feels to be one's head, in what the traditional sort of yoga schools call the Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus, that becomes the normal seat or station of consciousness. But here, there is a rising even higher, and a centering of the being well above the mind in some cosmic vastness that is a major change in experience that takes place and stabilizes itself at this point and tries to integrate the rest of the being around that particular kind of experience. If you look at the language Sri Aurobindo uses, he gives full value to the very large flexibility of this consciousness. In this particular paragraph, he is using terms which constantly should not be misconstrued as the only way things can be. So, for example, towards the end we see, in this boundless largeness, not only the separate ego, but all sense of individuality, even of a subordinated or instrumental individuality, may entirely disappear. The cosmic existence, the cosmic consciousness, the cosmic delight, the play of cosmic forces are alone left. So this kind of experience may include a loss of self, complete disappearance and dissolution of self, of the very sense of self. However, even such a dissolution of the sense of self may not be the experience of this consciousness, or may only be a stage in the experience of this consciousness. There is an interesting place where Sri Aurobindo compares Raman Maharshi's experience of the cosmic consciousness achieved through the Antaratman, or the inner Atman, with his own achieved through Brahman Nirvana, the dissolution into Brahman. He says that Raman Maharshi's experience, somebody describes to him as being one in which, he says, something opened in my heart, and everywhere I looked, I saw I. In other words, the great Paramatman, the Self, was made apparent in all things. Everywhere he saw the I, which was no longer his small self, but the one self there is. Sri Aurobindo said, my own experience of the cosmic consciousness was one in which every sense of self disappeared. So this kind of disappearance, abolition, erasure of the self, of the Atman, sense of self, is also a possibility within this particular consciousness. However, it may be that it is a stage, because the cosmic Purusha also has a sense of self. Atman or Paramatman is one of the aspects of Brahman, and hence it may be replaced by a different kind of sense of cosmic self. This kind of transition is also talked about in Savitri, particularly in the case of Savitri, who lives in this sort of consciousness for a long period without anybody knowing that she is living in this consciousness. But her sense of self is gone. Only much later it is replaced by a different sense of self.
Debashish?
Yes,
now, it seems to me like the loss of the sense of self can be a temporary thing, that you can experience that, the loss of the sense of self, in a moment of cosmic consciousness, and then the ego, like, reconstitutes itself.
Yeah, now, you see, one of the things over here is that actually, there is a question mark in what you just said is quite interesting, because there is a question mark in what one calls, you know, studies of cosmic consciousness in today's, or mystical consciousness in today's world. It was started, so to say, these studies, I would kind of pin them almost to one of the great beginnings was made with William James in his Varieties of Religious Experience. And in those varieties and in the sort of description of these mystical experiences, he tries to categorize the principal characteristics. And one of them is transience. In other words, none of
yes.
these experiences are permanent. They are experienced for a while, and then, as you said, the ego reconstitutes itself. But this particular feature or characteristic has been questioned. And in a number of cases, when we talk about transformation, it may be that there are permanent changes to the consciousness. Not only these transient states of mystical experience mm-hmm. may lead ultimately to a transformation of being, which is permanent. And in this case, he's talking about some such permanent change, where though this also, as I said, may be a temporary condition of this loss of self, but it may be not the ego which reconstitutes itself, but a different kind of cosmic personality which reconstitutes itself.
Okay.
However, you're right. I also believe that, as he will point out later in the next paragraph, part of the fullness of achieving cosmic consciousness lies in the reconstitution of some sense of person, though its nature may be quite different from what
right.
it was.
In Evelyn Underhill's book, Mysticism, she has, I believe it's five stages of attaining cosmic consciousness. And the last one is what she calls unitive consciousness, where the person has achieved this unity with the cosmic mind, but still retains a much altered sense of self. But in the initial stage of the revelation, the initial stage of revelation, the sense itself is temporarily dissolved, that it's only a temporary state. And then she describes you pass through several more states before you get to the unitive state of consciousness.
Yes, that's true. I think Vishwa Aurobindo deals with it. There is something similar in the sense that the cosmic consciousness may completely obliterate the sense of self, but a different sense of self, which is a higher sense of self, can take its place.
Yes.
Devishish?
Yes, please.
Isn't that like, I always thought that experiences repeated could lead to realization. Isn't that like a permanent change as the result of a lot of approaches and experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a permanent change in the sense that one is no longer what one was to start with, and various experiences may repeat to a point where a certain condition, there's an ontological change, a change in the condition of being, which becomes a settled condition of a certain individual or individual experience.
That is
what you're calling realization or transformation of being.
What would be a siddhi? Is that?
A siddhi would be a kind of, that's interesting because when you're talking about transformation, there are two kinds of transformations. One is what you call realization, is a transformation of being. A transformation of being is a different kind of sense of what one is, of sense of experience. One's experience of reality changes.
Mm-hmm.
But if one's functioning also changes, in other words, if the very various instruments of experience, not experience, instruments of expression, undergo radical change so that they become, to some extent, quote-unquote, superhuman, those are siddhis. Those are called siddhis. So that is a transformation of nature. Transformation, therefore, can be transformation of being or transformation of nature. Transformation of being could be called realization. Transformation of nature is what is called siddhi.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. There's a parallel as well to the siddhis in the Christian tradition, and it's called the gifts of the spirit, when one has transformed from natural man into spiritual man.
Yes.
Also wanted to, I was thinking that, this experience, realization, ultimately these are, we are basically looking at becomings, right? If it is higher becoming, meaning if it is going upward, it's not really excluding something which was there before, but in including and going beyond, right? Like, so every step upward will include, literally I cannot say every, because there could be some intermediate, incomplete experience or whatever. But what I mean is that in essential sense, that more the becoming upward, in a higher layer of consciousness, it actually includes the past and perceives it with a higher light or more inclusive view. And also the becoming, itself is dynamic by nature, so it's not supposed to be stuck at one place anyway, right?
Yeah, quite true. And the idea of inclusiveness is also true, but that sense of inclusiveness may have discontinuities in it. That's the reason why, as he himself says in his own experience, the whole notion of self, not only ego, but the very idea of self completely disappeared for a good while, and then only it reappeared at some other level. So when they say that it got included, or it was included at that higher level, that's very true. Or there may be a reorganization of some of the other elements that seem to disappear for some time. But also one must recognize the fact that it may in reality occur through temporary dislocations and complete disappearances.
Bindu, would you like to read next?
Sure. I'm a bit lost. We're starting with, but there can be many formulations, right? But there can be many formulations of overmind consciousness and experience. For the overmind has a great plasticity and is a field of multiple possibilities. In place of uncentered and unplaced diffusion, there may be the sense of the universe in oneself or as oneself. But there too, this self is not the ego. It is an extension of a free and pure essential self-consciousness, or it is an identification with the all. The extension or the identification constituting a cosmic being, a universal individual. In one state of a cosmic consciousness, there is an individual included in cosmos but identifying himself with all in it, with the things and beings, with the thought and sense, the joy and grief of others. In another state, there is inclusion of beings in oneself and the reality of their life as part of one's own being. Often there is no rule or governance of the immense movement, but a free play of the universal nature to which what was the personal being responds with a passive acceptance of a dynamic identity, while yet the spirit remains free and undisturbed by any bondage to the reactions of this passivity or this universal and impersonal identification and sympathy. But with a strong influence of full action of the overmind, a very integral sense of governance, a complete supporting or overruling presence and direction of the cosmic self or the Ishwara can come in and become normal. Or a special center may be revealed or created, overtopping and dominating the physical instrument, the individual in fact of existence, but impersonal in feeling and recognized by a precognition as something instrumental to action of the transcendent and universal being. In the transition towards supermind, this centralizing action tends towards the discovery of the true individual replacing the dead ego, a being who is in his essence one with the supreme self, one with the universe in extension, and yet a cosmic center and circumference of specialized action of the infinite.
So this is exactly where he is reconstituting the sense of person at the level of the divine. And as he points out, due to the vastness of his consciousness, this may be experienced in a variety of ways or also in a variety of stages. Each individual may have a different kind of access to it, one may say. So he gives two or three possibilities here. One in which there is an emergent sense of self, which is yet universal and in relation with all other things in the universe as if they are parts of itself. This receives whatever experiences others have, almost as its own experience. This kind of vast sympathy, one may say, with all other constituted experiences, is one of the aspects of a possibility of cosmic consciousness. The other one he's talking about over here is that there is a including or a kind of a encompassing personality, one inside which everything seems to dwell. In other words, one almost develops a unity or identity with the cosmic consciousness as that inside which the world and all its creatures move. So this sense of vast universality, whether possessed as a kind of a being that is, you know, uncentered or centered somewhere almost non-local and experiencing different kinds of experiences, but in itself, and what characterizes it and differentiates it from others is this sense of a vast equality in which passive experience is taking place, and it is not something which is overwhelmed by any experience. Its natural condition is to include all forms of experience in itself without feeling overwhelmed. So, however it may come, this is in a way a kind of a growth into something totally cosmic that includes other kinds of consciousnesses as aspects of itself. Now, to what extent the nature participates in this universality is also a part of a growth of consciousness. Cosmic consciousness also has many aspects to it. Again, cosmic consciousness may be cosmic in being. That is the envelopment. There is a sense of a consciousness that envelops everything. It may also be cosmic in nature. That is, one's consciousness can identify with every other consciousness in its experiences and its nature. So these kinds of experiences are all varieties of the domains of the overmind. Ultimately, as he's pointing out, there is the development of a centralizing facility, which may include what he's calling the opening up of a higher center. This again, this use of the term center has also to be taken in terms of what we were discussing earlier regarding the centers above the mind. The Sahasrara itself, the thousand-petaled lotus, which often is considered to be the center of Sushupti or the luminous leap of trance, may in fact stabilize and become one's normal waking condition, center of one's waking condition. And in the overmind, it might actually open up even higher ranges of itself, new ranges or new centers of chakras of being, which were till then completely asleep in the light, may show themselves as forms of locations of individuality of Purusha and Shakti in which one can reside. And this is what he's talking about over here. A special center may be revealed or created. So this is the formation of a new center. Overtopping and dominating the physical instrument, individual in fact of existence, but impersonal in feeling and recognized by a free cognition as something instrumental to the action of a transcendental and universal being. It's like an individual center of a infinite being, something which is undefined and infinite, has a center, a central location. One may think of this as an overmental seat of the Jivatman. So from this particular vantage, there is a possibility of something higher, something of the infinite being, utilizing the individual as its seat, and the possibility of the third transformation that he's talking about, or the supramental transformation. So entering into this, individuality, where from a condition of passivity in which a vast consciousness bears the impacts and waves of cosmic experience, to a sense of the Ishvara, a governing being, a being of will, which is ultimately cosmic, but at the same time sensed as the power that puts everything in order. This replaces the whole notion of the person. And that itself ultimately reveals itself as having a kind of an instrumental action that is open to something even more infinite that is beyond it. Now, a question may be asked about what is the certainty that some sense of self will emerge, you know, the centering of the being. Even these cosmic, the stages of cosmic consciousness seem so overwhelming that it may very well be that one can reside in some kind of state of experience and either drop from it into one's older condition or be, sort of stable in some intermediate condition. This is also possible, but what he's talking about elsewhere, you find that he makes this entire process reside on a sense of surrender, that surrender to the higher Shakti, to the divine Shakti, which one is constantly invoking to take us to the fullness of the experience of integrality, is what ensures that these states of experience are ultimately continuously mounting to this condition of transformation in which the Ishvara emerges. And then something even higher can emerge. Because as he says, reality is infinite. And any status of being can always be overtopped by a higher status.
So, Devashish, at this point, how is he not? I mean, how does one distinguish between these stages? It seems that, like, at every point, there's so much flexibility that the boundaries between them, even as he defines them, are very, amorphous, so to say, between the higher mind, the illumined mind, the intuitive mind, the over mind. There are definitions, yes, but even then, it seems that everything is kind of merging into each other.
Cannot hear anyone. Is anybody talking?
Oh, no. Yeah, so there was the, sorry, I think I was muted. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can. Yes.
Yeah. So the question was, how does one distinguish between these states? Because it seems that once it becomes so flexible, each of them, it seems that they are all merging into each other, with every stage having possibilities of not just one state but many states. So it seems that they are all kind of very amorphous, correct?
They are, Sham. It is true. They are very amorphous, and they are even more amorphous to us in our condition.
Sure.
You see, this is one of the difficulties, even perhaps, let's say, of reading Savitri or reading some of Sri Aurobindo's material. Because the subtleties between these various states are, in some, to a large extent, alien to the consciousness that is not native to these conditions.
Sure.
Even if we have certain experiences or touches or hints of experiences of this kind, it is actually only when one resides in these conditions that one can make distinctions there.
Sure.
So the answer to your question really is, it's only with repeated experience and with stable existence in these forms of consciousness that distinctions can be made. In Sri Aurobindo's own case, we can see, for example, that when he started having these kinds of experiences in the Alipur jail, a little before 1910 when he went to Pondicherry. But up until 1920, almost 10 years, he hadn't made the very clear distinctions that emerged later in his writing. It was still largely amorphous, and he has constantly, if you look at the record of yoga, kept reformulating a lot of things. So it is, your question is a very pertinent and relevant one. One must use the higher intuition itself, but one has to constantly purify the understanding and arrive at clarity of vision with regard to experience, which is like science. It's really a science of experience. At this level, because it is cosmic experience, there is a universality to it. In one's own experience, one can arrive at universal understandings.
Yeah, thank you, Devashista. So it's 9:30. If there are no more questions, perhaps Devashishda, we can stop here and continue next week.
Sure.
And on an ending note, I also wanted to say that supposedly this April 4th Sunday marks the 100th anniversary of Sri Aurobindo's arrival in Pondicherry. So I think perhaps Keka or others can say if there are any special meditations and such to commemorate it.
Yes, happy darshan.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And Lova is also here. Actually, I met her day before yesterday. Mm-hmm. She will also be joining the meditation.
Nice. So, shall we stop here, the brief meditation?
Yeah, sure. I think it's appropriate. I think where we are right now is such an appropriate sort of stage in the contemplation of Sri Aurobindo's, coming to Pondicherry, because these are the states and experiences that he stabilized in that period. So I think, we can keep this with us as our, sort of contemplation of Sri Aurobindo's 100 years in Pondicherry.
Thank you, Devashishtha.